Hey, After Buzzers, before we move on to your next topic, we just want to say thanks to our sponsor, Anchor. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. Plus, there are creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Also, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. Plus, you can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, and it's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to Anchor FM to get started.
Today on Spotlight On, Chips Enough of the band Enough's Enough, who have a great new album out called Diamond Boy. They're out on tour as part of the SiriusXM Hair Nation tour with Bullet Boys, Jack Russell's Great White. Spotlight On starts now.
You're tuned in to AfterBuzz TV, the ESPN of TV talk. Now, let the buzz begin.
Hi there, I'm Christian Blatt, and thrilled to be sitting down with the one and only Chips Enough. We hear the title track from their new album, Enough's Enough, Diamond Boy. Chip, thanks so much for joining us here.
Thanks for having me, Christian. I love your little studio here. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a great setup. I mean, there's four studios, sometimes, and we do hundreds of shows in a week here, mostly after shows about TV, but we have a great format where we can do these sit-down one-on-ones with somebody like you, so
yeah,
we appreciate
that.
You coming here.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned in the little tease at the top, the latest album is called Diamond Boy. It's from Frontiers Records.
Yep.
You guys are currently out on the SiriusXM Hair Nation tour, as I said. Bullet Boys, Jack Russell's Great White. For tickets, information on the tour, on the album, just go to enoughisenough.com, and I'm going to spell it, enuffzenuff.com. Now, usually when I interview somebody, I always try to stay away from the obvious questions that you get asked all the time, but I feel like it's a decent starting point. What comes first, you going by the name Chips Enough or the band name Enough's Enough?
Well, I would say the band name does. I put this band together back in 1984. I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And with a dream and aspirations like any other band, nobody gears up anything for failure. And we had some good songs, and we just worked and kept recording. I'm from a little small town called Blue Island, Illinois. And they had a little apartment out there. Put a little four-track Fostex recorder. And we'd record all the songs there. And eventually, after years and years of trial and error, we were discovered by Doc McGee, and we were able to take the band to the next level, which is making records.
Right, and Doc McGee these days best known for working with Kiss, and he has for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think I remember reading recently that I guess you did some shows opening for Kiss, and it was the first time that they'd seen you. You're the singer in the band now.
That's correct.
And talk a little bit about what Doc and Paul Stanley said to you after they saw you.
Well, I was doing the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, which they have every single year in Los Angeles. A guy named David Fischoff, who used to manage the Monkees, puts it together. And all kinds of rock stars are from Slash to Jeff Beck. The Aerosmith guys, everyone comes in there and plays. And in Sesame Street terms, it's regular people at work, doctors, attorneys, lawyers. They pay money to play with their favorite musicians and live their life vicariously for a week through the eyes of these guys. And you plug your guitar, play drums, whatever it is, sing, and you learn songs, three or four songs, and you play the Whiskey a Go-Go or one of the iconic venues around the country. So fast forward, I'm doing it with Paul Stanley. And we're at the Whiskey A Go-Go backstage, and no one's back there, just Paul and myself. And he says, Chip, you want to play the Kiss Cruise with me? And I said, you don't tell. When he asks for a favor, Paul Stanley, you accept that and say thank you. And I said, well, of course we would. He goes, well, I asked you guys last year if you wanted to do it, and for some reason you declined. And I didn't even know about it. I said, we're probably in the studio making a record, Paul, but I'd love to do it. And he got on the phone with Doc, and within 30 seconds we were on the Kiss Cruise. So we played the shows. It was four shows. I had his son, Evan, up on stage who played in the band called The Dives. I pulled him up. He's a big Enough's Enough fan. I had him play Baby Loves You with us in front of the audience. And all the guys from Kiss showed up, along with the Dead Daisies and King's X, and all the great bands were on the bill. And after the show, Doc and Paul said, Chip, you're a great front man. You did a wonderful job. You should have been doing this 10 years ago. So that was a nice shot in the arm for me, because I certainly come from a band full of great musicians. And to be able to reach Doc and the guys from Kiss and get their thumbs up and an approval for what we're doing certainly was very good for us. And from that, I came back to Chicago, and it was a shot of adrenaline for me, and it gave me some confidence. And a week later, I got a telephone call from Ace Frehley saying, I'm going on a 30-day tour. I'd love to have Enough's Enough open for us. And that's really what helped the band. That was the catalyst for taking off and getting this record. record deal with Frontiers.
Yeah, I know you were out on tour with Ace. It was about a year and a half ago because I was at the show in Beverly Hills that you guys had played. And it's not that I hadn't thought about the band in a while, but it could be completely honest. I hadn't seen anything in a while, you know. And so this album comes out, and I'm like, this is your 14th album, right? Unless I've counted wrong.
It's the 16th album. Okay. It's really 21, but that's counting the greatest hits and a few live albums that we've put out through the years as well.
But even so, it's like consistently albums have come out, and this is a day and age when, you know, well, speaking of Kiss, Gene Simmons has said, I don't see why we would make any more albums. He's also said things like Rock is Dead, but I love when bands make new albums. So talk about for you why you think it's still important to make new music.
Well, Gene can say that right now because rumor has it, if you pushed him off his wall, he'd break his neck 20 times, okay? So it's easy for him to sling mud because he lives in a glass house, okay? For me, it's about art and putting records out, and all the artists are doing it out there. The great ones are just continuing to put records out, and guys who sold millions of records, they're hungry still. And we want to keep it fresh and exciting for ourselves as well. So you put new music out there. It could be a movie, a soundtrack, a TV show, a commercial. Somebody's going to hear something, go, you know what? This is really fresh and innovative, and it trips my trigger. Let's help these guys out. So I like putting new music out there. It's a challenge. If I can quote the great John Lennon, I've said in a million interviews, all the great songs have already been written. It's up to us, ours, to find them and bring them down to you. And it's quite a challenge to come up and find these songs. But I got a great band with wonderful writers. I got Tony Fennell from Ultravox, the former lead singer of Ultravox, who took Major's place. I have Tori Stofragen, and Tori played in a band called New Black Seven, and they're a terrific band, like a country tinge rock and roll band. And I have Daniel Benjamin Hill, a solid drummer who's a songwriter as well. And collectively, I think we really work well. It's a good chemistry, and we like where we're taking the band right now, and it seems that we're causing some inroads, and it's very exciting because we're in a day and age where it's tough for all the bands out there. I wish everyone well, especially the new bands, because it's almost as if there's too much product and not enough demand. So you got to go out there and you got to make some noise and you got to hustle. And my suggestion and advice to any bands out there is try to make a great record and then take it to the streets. Meet as many people as you can, because this business is predicated on friendships and relationships. So you work hard and the money follow.
Yeah, and the thing that you realize, you sort of alluded to it, you know, it's like new music reaches people in so many different ways now. You know, you'll have people who have like a single debut in a video game, or, you know, it's included in a TV show, played, you know, going to commercial on a football game, however you can get it in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the point you made is you can't do that if you don't make the new music, you know. So
no, and people are going to just go, you're living on your past, and hey, that's fine if you got a past. A lot of us, you know, it's difficult to leave an indelible mark anywhere. And I remember Lil Steven from Bruce Springsteen said, Chip, if you're just a footnote, you're doing okay. So I think that we're doing fine right now, but we're not satisfied. We're taking it to the next level, and we're working real hard every single day.
Which is great. You know, to sort of backtrack for a second, you know, I guess either Doc or Paul said you should have done this 10 years ago. And there have been times in the band's history, you know, when Donnie V originally left, I know Johnny Monaco was singing. Did you just feel like you weren't ready to sing? Did you even think of it? Or was it just, well, we got to find somebody else, and you didn't even think if it was something for you to do?
Well, I sat down with Donnie in the bedroom and wrote those songs. And, mm-hmm. and wherever we wrote them, it didn't matter. We were writing machines. And he's very profound, very, very prolific writer. So when he sashayed in 2013, disillusioned by the business and had some issues, personal issues that he needed to take care of, he said, that's it for me. I got to take a break for a while. And he sashayed, and Monaco was the perfect guy because he's a great imitator and a wonderful musician. So I said, okay, well, let's try it like this. And then when he got, I think he just got sick of the daily grind. And he basically through an email, which was not the nicest way to go, but he basically said in Sesame Street terms that I can't do it anymore. You know, you have to take a break. And so I had no choice. And I thought about it and I discussed it with my wife, basically, and said, you know, maybe I just go out. I used to play with Missing Persons. I play with Adler from Guns N' Roses for years, and Adler's Appetite. Maybe and there's tons of bands I could play in, you know. It doesn't matter. I could do any style of music. I thought, well, maybe there's something else I have to do. But I just didn't want to give up enough stuff. I feel there's a great legacy there. We have wonderful songs. I've given 29 years of my life with the band the way it was, and I said, I'm going to take a chance and do this. So when Doc and Paul Stanley both gave me that nice words of encouragement, that that went a long ways. And I figured it's time to take a chance on this. And if the ship's going to go down, well, I'm the captain, so I'll make it happen. And I'm pleasantly surprised because the shows have been well attended. The fans have spoken, and 99.9 of them say, you know, it sounds great. You're playing the songs. You're keeping it going, Chip. We're behind you.
Yeah, I mean, the band sounded great when I saw you guys open for Ace Frehley. I'm excited. I'll be at the show at the Wiltern tomorrow night. Looking forward to seeing all the bands. But all the, you know, so all the hundreds, thousands of hours of stage time you'd logged, how different is it the first time when the lights go on and you're actually out there as the singer in the band?
Well, I've always been sort of like the front man. I sang on all the records, and I sang a lot of the harmonies and lead vocals live, but not the whole set. And it's quite a challenging job because I feel I'm taking the place of my brother, who I feel is one of the quintessential singers of our generation. He's really a wonderful, great lead vocalist.
Yeah, definitely.
But I can wear this dress, and I've proven that. And I think I have my own timbre. And it's just the biggest challenge is, you know, singing for a couple hours every single night. That's the toughest part. This tour, we're only doing an hour set, so it's not so much pressure on me. And it's not like the old days in the 80s and 90s where we play shows and there's people backstage and there's extracurricular activities and tons of alcohol and substance abuse. We're cleaned up. We're straight and focused. And we just really want to make a great experience for not only for the listeners but for our fans, but for ourselves as well, because we got to do this every single day. And it's a challenging job. So every single night singing these songs, I'm confident I can do it, and I've proven I can. So just a matter of the blessing from the good Lord so I can sing these songs every night. I remember Steven Tyler saying, nothing's worse than getting up in the afternoon, you're going to take a shower and get ready for the show and sound check, and you realize you got no pipes that day, and you're like, oh, man, where am I going to find this?
Yeah.
Because these people that come out to these shows is the first time they fell in love, or first time they get high, or first time they experience something great in their life, and they remember that, and they want to get back to that one more time. So you really want it to be a wonderful experience for them. So at the end of the day, my focus is every single day. Watch my intake on everything. No alcohol, no nothing. It sounds like I'm no fun, but listen, I love partying, hanging out with all you guys out there and girls. But I want to play and sing well every single day, so there's a lot of discipline there. And my grandpa used to say it all the time, son, a little bit of discipline never hurt anybody, and he's right.
No, that's definitely true. I remember within the last few weeks, I saw a headline, I think it was from blabbermouth.com, and you were sort of talking about the old days, and you've probably seen this a lot. You know, I think you said that the band did more cocaine than Guns N' Roses and Aerosmith combined. Obviously, very hard to focus like that, and that, you know, Aerosmith's a perfect example. You know, sort of the fact that they were ever able to achieve anything in the 70s, yeah. When you hear about them, you know, Guns N' Roses is sort of the same thing. And I don't know, like, as somebody who's fairly straight-laced most of my life, I'm always amazed just the fact that it's like you're still able to get out on stage. But I guess the art suffers when that's what's going
on.
Well,
the songs come. You get great songs from that. And I got vilified by the Blabbermouth people on that, you know, saying, you guys didn't make enough money. You didn't do that. Listen, we did well. We've sold over a million records.
Sure.
And we got big advances. Back in the 80s and 90s, record companies were giving us a Brinks truck full of money. And I think it's nice to be honest and open and tell the truth, because in this day and age, that's quite refreshing. So when I said that, you know, it was a little bit tongue in cheek, but no, we did do that much. We were out of control. We had a big tour bus. Record company was giving us $25,000 a week. We're traveling around the country, opening for Badlands or Mr. Big or whoever the band was out there that was doing well. Cheap Trick, Def Leppard, and that was tons of cocaine. And we were burning the candle at both ends. We'd go over to the Mexico border and we'd grab pounds of pot and throw it on the bus. We were out of control, but it was a great time. We didn't hurt anybody. It was just burning the candle at both ends, and it was 24/7. There was no wick left. And all the bands, not just the Aerosmith or Guns N' Roses, way before those bands too, in the Led Zeppelin days and Pink Floyd and all them bands, they did everything, and they just didn't want to talk about it because they felt maybe it would hurt their reputation. I think it's refreshing that I'm an honest artist and I tell the truth, and the fans seem to love it. And there's a couple of jagoffs out there that might not be happy about it, but sorry, guys. You know, sometimes the truth hurts.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, an early proponent of the bands was Howard Stern, and I think one of the things that he liked the most was just how honest you were,
absolutely.
You know, and I think that it's very refreshing, because every once in a while you find somebody who has that kind of sit-down interview where you're like, oh, you actually learn stuff about them. But for the most part, it's like, you know, there's a piece of paper like the one in front of me, and like the record companies like talk about these things, and you know what you don't talk about, and you know, you tell the same stories 10, 15 times. And when you're a fan of a band like I am, a lot of times you're like, oh, I've heard this story. Oh, I've also heard this story, you know? And so it's great when somebody like you just will tell stories like you just told me, you know? And when you're out on tour back in those days with Def Leppard, there's got to be plenty of drugs to go around, plenty of women to go around. So yeah. The idea that you guys weren't big enough, I find that silly.
Yeah, for in 2002, we were out on the 2001, 2002, we were out in the Glam Slam Metal Jam tour. It was Poison, Quiet Riot, Warrant. And Enough's Enough. Nobody was allowed to come on our bus. Mark Hogue was running the show. Mark Hogue works. He's a road manager. He used to be with Aerosmith. Now he's with the Moody Blues. Nobody was allowed to come by the Enough's Enough bus, which was dubbed the Yellow Submarine. And we were out of control beyond belief. And for anybody that's followed the band, they've seen that. There was, you know, we were falling apart. And we were having problems there. And I always come up to all the fans and all the musicians out there and say, guys, don't do what we did. You know, if anything, if you look at us as a barometer of what not to do. But one thing I do know is when there's there things that happen in, through your career in the early days where there's some substance abuse problems and your intake is questionable, the songs still come. That gives you the ideas for the tunes. We wouldn't have these songs if it wasn't for those little moments that we went through in life, you know, those lapse of judgment times. So I always give advice that if you stay away from that stuff, you're gonna have a much longer career. It's gonna be a good run for you. However, you know, sometimes when you experiment a little bit, you can come up with some great stuff. And all the great bands have done it way before us, 20, 30 years before we even did that stuff. Even in the old days, in the jazz days. So those guys were always experimenting, playing games, and they come up with some great tunes, and those songs are timeless. So it's teeter-totter.
It's hardly a secret, yeah. But, I mean, Ray Charles was a heroin addict, you know? Yeah. I mean, and who was, you know, so many people were.
Well, some of the greatest musicians in the world have had some problems there, but their music lives forever.
Yeah, and a lot of people manage it in different ways, like Alice Cooper's talked about drinking literally a case of beer, you know, in the 70s, and then it went much further. So obviously there has to come a point though where you're like, well, this was all fun, but I think the band's really starting to suffer. So is there something specific that happens where you're like, all right, let's really focus more on the band, and you know, it's fun to party and all, but let's really put the band
first.
Yeah,
it's called growing up.
Right.
That's what it is, because when you're a kid and you don't envision an ending. So when the record company's giving you dough, you think it's going to keep coming in. You're fine with that. The whole business has changed since Napster. So now a lot of people are getting stuff online, and it's streaming, and that's what the big thing is right now. But listen, we just played a show last night in San Diego at the House of Blues, and we sold almost 100 records. And I thought, that's pretty good. You know, in the old days, you couldn't sell records, by the way, because it was a taboo. Record companies didn't want you to do it because you would piss off the stores. And then the stores wouldn't carry your album, and you needed that. And you had MTV and the different networks out there playing your stuff. You want people to go into the store and get your stuff. So nowadays, it's bands pretty much, it's real self-sufficient. And you go out there, you play a show, and a lot of bands are doing meet and greets. And I understand what they do. We don't do them, but a lot of bands have to do that because it might mean the difference between playing that city the next day. So for us, it's about getting out there and playing these shows and giving it the best performance we can, and then hanging with the fans afterwards, because without the fans, there is nothing to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, obviously so much of the business is focused on touring right now. And to the point you made, yeah, there's all of these meet and greets. And, you know, there's the high level, you know, Aerosmith meet and greets where there's one for Steven, one for Joe, one for the other guys. Yeah. And then there's also, you know, smaller bands who for like $100, you'll get a ticket, you'll get a CD, and you'll get, you know, and they'll package it all together for a ticket that probably would have cost $20. But like you said, that's the cost of touring is so expensive.
Yes,
it's like you need to sort of package it those ways.
Yeah, and this tour, you know, we're in an Oscar Mayer Wienerwagen with front and back shocks. Okay, it's way different. It's not the old tour bus. There's no budget like that at all. We want to come home and we want to at least pay our bills. But we go at the shows when we're finished playing, we go and meet the fans out there. We do a thing called the Soundcheck Experience, where fans can come in there for a small pittance of a ticket price, and you can watch like a 3-song soundcheck, and you can hang out with Tony Fennell and Tori Stoffer Reagan and Daniel Benjamin Hill and myself and take some pictures and stuff and hang out. Nobody's around, just us. And it's a nice experience. It's not 2 minutes and get them out of the place. Where a lot of the bigger bands I get, their time is very valuable and it's $2,500. You want to sit. But those guys are rock icons. They've been around for 50 years and you don't know how much longer they're going to be here. So yeah. it's a special experience when you can sit down with somebody in Guns N' Roses or an Aerosmith, somebody like that. That's really special. We're not there yet. So I think it's good that we're a band that's very transparent. And we go out and do these shows and then we hang out with the fans and we're there the whole night.
Yeah. And sort of the way you're talking about it, it's really an experience. If you're doing like a sound check, you're going to get three songs. You're probably going to do songs that maybe wouldn't find their way into the set. So the big fans are the ones that are going to go there. And anybody that I know that's ever done that for a band, they're always like, those are the experiences that are worth it. Sometimes the cattle call with the super big bands where you have like a group picture with people you don't even know. And the band, you're like, well, I don't know if that was worth $1,000.
I remember going in 95, 96. My old manager was Herbie Herbert, if I can brag for a second. Herbie Herbert used to manage bands like Journey. He's the iconic manager. Everyone loves him. He had bands like Roxette, Mr. Big, Steve Miller, and there's countless other ones. They're all Europe. He managed Europe for a while. And he was telling me stories. And he set me up one time at a gig, a sound check for Plant Page. And here I am now, 25 years later, talking about it, how great that was. 1996, actually, so it wasn't that long ago. But
22 years ago.
And just being on a side stage watching Jimmy Page tune his guitar, I'll never forget that ever. And then they came out and played a couple songs and listened to Plant's Pipes and watching those two guys together interact. It left an indelible mark with me. So I think it's soundtrack experience is only fitting to the diehard Enough Snuff fan or any band, any fans that are out there, like any bands, to get a chance to go see something like that. You'll never forget it.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because it sort of reminded me. When I was in college, I interned at Saturday Night Live. So on Thursday, the musical bands will rehearse.
Yeah.
And they'll do the same song 3-4 times.
Yeah.
And, you can kind of sneak in the back and watch, and there's maybe 20 people in there. But you're seeing, like, there was a show that Jimmy Page was doing a song from the Godzilla movie with Puff Daddy, which half of that wasn't exciting to me. Yeah. But just, like, oh, there's Jimmy Page.
Yeah.
And you're just like, there's not that many people watching this right now. So, when you can get an experience that you're like, not that many people had that, those, to me, are definitely worth it, I can see.
Yeah, anytime sure. I could sneak in, I remember sneaking in for the Stones, too. I knew one of the guys that worked with the Stones, and he got us back there. He wanted us to do a sound check. He wanted Enough Snuff to actually play the sound check because the Stones weren't going to come in that day and get on stage and play through their gear, which I thought was super exciting.
Wow.
So anytime you get a chance to do something where you're around the heavyweights, for me, I'm a fan way before I'm anything else, And at the end of the day, I don't call myself a rock star. I'm a musician, a working musician that works hard, and I dedicate my whole life to this craft. That's why I have so many records out, and there's other records I've done too, if I could brag for a second.
Sure.
Different stuff that I've played with different musicians and performed on the records or produced their records. And I don't even talk about that. It's not on the website. I don't say anything about it. I don't have a Wikipedia page going, oh, Chip worked with Journey and Steve Miller and all these different guys because I don't need to. I did it myself and I'm real happy about that. But I know that at the end of the day, I take that with me. That means a lot. It's my little kangaroo pouch, and it's full right now of wonderful moments and memories that nobody could take away from me.
Yeah, and to that point, when I was putting my notes together for this conversation that we're having, there wasn't a lot on just you. There's a lot on the band. The band's website has a great biography. Whoever wrote it did a great job. But, just stuff about you, there it's not really out there.
No, I got a pretty big ego, too, but it's not that bad, okay? I think leave the work up to... that's my legacy right there. And people, if they search and they find it, that's fantastic. And I'm grateful for that. But at the end of the day, my big focus is our band Enough's Enough and putting out great music and doing wonderful shows and travel around the whole world, meeting everybody.
One of the things that it does mention on the band's website is, I guess, you started out, it says that you were formerly a jock. You played a lot of sports in high school.
Yeah.
What's the moment where you go from, oh, this is fun playing sports, but I really have this fire, this need to play music? Is there even a moment? Do you see
sure.
a band or...
Sure, it was for me in the early days. I was watching, asking my father if I could stay up late at night and watch American Bandstand or what it was, Don Kirshner's rock concert, Midnight Special. It would be on late at night, and my dad, Alice Cooper's on tonight. Can I watch this? Or Mott the Hoople's, Bowie or somebody cool. And my father was kind enough to let me watch that, and then he let me listen to his records too. And he had, Black Sabbath and Canned Heat and Crack the Sky, crazy bands. A lot of people don't hear about. Captain Beyond, wonderful band.
I mean, I know that more people have heard of him, but like I remember going through my dad's vinyl, which oddly enough stopped right at 1974, the year he got married. All of a sudden, he didn't have any more records, but he had all these great records for the 10 years before.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Strawberry Alarm Clock, what's that?
Yeah,
you know, and you just put a Moby Grape. You just these crazy names that I hadn't heard.
My dad had those records. Yeah. Okay, I just absolutely loved all that stuff, and he periodically let me listen to it. And then I was playing baseball, and I tried out for the Milwaukee Brewers, Cincinnati Reds, Chicago White Sox, Kansas City Royals, and there was a guy named Benny Centura. My grandfather played with the Sox in the 30s. Benny Centura used to work with Bill Veeck in the old days, and he seen me playing in a game and brought his scouts out and had me come out there and pitch a couple scrimmage games. And I didn't throw hard enough, and I was a good pitcher, too. I really did well. I threw a curveball, slider, a forkball, but I had more to say, I think, writing a song than I did pitching. But I took the elements of being on a baseball team and tried to use that for my band when we first put Enough's Enough together. And it took years and years to get a break, believe me. But I think the music bug hit me pretty early, and it just took a little time for me to actually get enough strength up and courage to go out there and pursue that career. And after I graduated from a high school in Chicago called Brother Rice High School, then I said, by the way, Kevin Cronin from REO Speedwagon graduated from there.
Oh, nice.
Years before me,
sure.
Of course. I moved to Los Angeles to my aunt's house, and it was, I want to say Santa Bernardino, but it was from somewhere else probably, but, here in California. And I was in a band called Degeneration. It was a punk rock band, and that's what gave me the bug. We were opening for Grateful Dead and Boss Gags. We had killer gigs. And decent management, and his family was helping us. We were rehearsing at my aunt's house, and that's what really gave me the bug. And I came back. The band fell apart, same reason as all bands fall apart.
Yeah.
And I moved back to Chicago, and then I said, you know what? I've done this. I see how it is. I'm going to put my own band together.
And how do you – is Donnie the first person you meet for the band that becomes Enough's Enough? Or was,
yeah, okay. Absolutely. Donnie, we adopted him to the family back in 1983. You know, he had a mother and father too, but they were separated. Mm-hmm. And I brought him around. My mom and dad absolutely adored him beyond belief. And they took him right into the family. And we started writing songs right away. There was a chemistry instantly. And those songs weren't great right away, but he always had pipes. He had a great tone. He was playing piano and singing when he was a young kid. And just like the guys in my band right now, these guys are all wonderful musicians that have been doing this forever. But we just built it up from the scratch. And I met this guy who was very successful in a studio called Rudder Recorders, and it was in Lake Geneva. And he was kind enough to let us come in the studio at 2 o'clock in the morning after Tupow or Jane's Addiction I always forget his name, Adrian Blue from King Crimson. Yeah, he's wonderful, great musician. And Skid Row, and they were all hanging out there, and we'd sneak in the studio at 2 o'clock in the morning and we'd start recording from 2 to 6 in the morning. And we did all our early stuff there, and then we met Doc McGee. And Doc and his brother Scott were there at the time, and we gave them one of our demo tapes, a cassette tape, by the way, folks. Cassettes were big back then. And he came to me a couple days later. He goes, Chip, I got 3 cassette tapes in my car, 2 of them are your band. I really like you guys. Like, oh, Doc, thanks. And I met his father earlier, and his father really liked Enough Snuff, it seemed like, you know. And anything that if Doc's father liked you, that wasn't a good barometer, because he thought, well, it's not good. That's what he used his father. He loves his dad, by the way. But his dad would be the guy. He'd ask him, what do you think? Like, for instance, they went to go see Motley Crue, and he says, yeah, what do you think, Dad? And his dad goes, this stuff is no good. And Doc goes, I got to sign these guys, you know. If Dad don't like them, they got a chance. So Doc was the guy, the catalyst that took us to Derek Shulman over at Atco Atlantic Records. Derek had his own imprint. He used to be a Polygram. He signed Cinderella and Bon Jovi, and they did very well. And then Atco Atlantic. Atlantic said, we're going to open up our subsidiary, Atco. We want you to run it. And he signed Pantera, Mr. Big. Bad Company. I know that. He also had AC/DC. He signed a couple other bands that didn't hit home runs that were terrific bands like Dan Reed Network and Tangier. And Enough Snuff got lucky. We got a deal with them, and never came to the studio anybody in the from the record company. And we recorded the whole record in Royal Records in Lake Geneva in about 2 weeks. And with New Thing, Fly Michelle, all the great singles we had in that record, and put it out just hoping that we get a chance. And at the time it was Poison, Motley Crue, Whitesnake, the Guns N' Roses. It was really saturated MTV. But there was a couple of pop bands that were in there, like Jellyfish, who I absolutely adore. and a couple other bands that were in there that got a chance. And for some reason, our video just took off, and it was real colorful and flamboyant. And it gave us a chance and gave us a little spark to start this career.
You know, speaking of that, you know, some of these Hair Nation tour dates are being hosted by Eddie Trunk, who is sort of like this godfather of hard rock and heavy metal.
Yeah,
and
he's encyclopedia.
Yeah, and he's also very outspoken of how much he doesn't like the term hair band and hair nation, even though one, the tour is called that, and two, he has a show on it.
Yeah.
And I do understand the point that he makes. I mean, I think some people try to use it affectionately, but that was thrown around a lot at that time. Yeah. What do you think about that term now, and was it something that you felt was a negative to have applied towards the band in the early days?
Well, I'm not sure it fits, okay, but...
Well, that's part of the problem.
You know, I'm at a point in my career, and for most musicians out there, who cares who drives a bus, guys? Let's get to the picnic, you know? I'm not going to worry about that. It's just a name. Sticks and stones will break your bones. Names will never hurt you, my grandma used to always say. And if you want to say that about that, how about Pantera? That's a hair band, too, then, because they came out with lipstick.
The way they started.
They came out with lipstick and makeup. They were colorful and flamboyant, just like we all. They were smart enough to get out of it when they knew it was time to move on. Same thing with Aerosmith. Same thing. Guns N' Roses, for sure.
If you look at the Welcome to the Jungle video versus the Lies era. Even.
If you're going to call them hair bands, let's get them all underneath one umbrella because they're all hair bands.
Yeah, and there was sort of, it almost seemed like there was this, you know, unspoken, it was like the escalation, you know, we always heard about the arms race in the 80s, and it was like, oh, Poison has this level. Well, the Vinnie Vincent invasion is going to go this much further, and, you know, he's always, who could do it? But then all of a sudden, I guess there really was a backlash against it. But I think for the part of your career we're talking about, it was a great timing because the first album came in 1989. I don't have that in front of me. Does that sound right?
Okay. That's correct.
So that's still a great time for what, you know, a lot of us think of as, you know, 80s hard rock / these hair bands, because there was a demand for it. And there was a great fit because MTV really liked playing these videos.
Of course.
And Fly High Michelle was after New Thing, right?
Yes.
But both of the videos, very bright, very...
They're hits.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's, you know, people talk about, well, it's hard to get new music played on the radio anymore. But now, like, videos, the only way to find videos is if you're already a fan of the band and you look for them on YouTube. But sort of talk about recording the album and then sort of how the image is shaped and how the videos are put together. You know, whose input is involved in all that? Is it the manager? Is it the record company? Is it the band?
It's all the above, okay? For us, it was record company. They had a vision and idea. Musically, for most bands, it's ourselves. Whether it's Guns N' Roses or any of the bands I mentioned before, they all just make their records and they come up with their songs and they present to the label, and the label says yes or no.
Right.
As far as the video goes, a lot of time label has an idea, and they hook you up with a director and a producer, and they listen, they write a storyboard out for the song that you're going to be pushing, and they put the whole thing together, you know, in conjunction with the band. Not too many bands that I know put videos together where they call the shots. Now, Guns N' Roses, that's one of a kind, where they had ideas. Axl's a real smart guy, he had a vision. And I'm sure he went to his people, you know, David Geffen or whoever, Tom Zutaut, and said, hey, here's my idea. And they go, okay, great, because he has some good ideas, let's face it. And those videos they did, back in the old days, all those videos, by the way, were $90,000 to $300,000. They all cost a Brinks truck. And record company was throwing tons of money, so who's going to say anything about it? And it just comes off your sales. So you go out on a tour and you work your ass off, leave your friends and your family, everybody behind. You go out on tour, and what do? You try to sell as many records as you can, reach as many people as you can, and when it's all said and done, they look at it and they go, okay, you sold 2 million records, you owe us $1 million, but we're going to go and do the next record, and we're going to give you a little advance, and it's constantly chasing the carrot. It really is. Wow. And I think the bands, when you're talking, getting back to the hair metal thing, so the bands, a lot of the bands that got away from the hair metal thing were bands that sold 5, 10, 15, 20 million records. So that was the barometer. Okay, well, they sold a lot of records, so let's not call them hair metal, but the bands that sold, you know, a 500,000 records or 1 million records, they're going to be the hair metal bands, because that's exactly what it is. I'm telling you right now, the industry did that and put a tag on it, and there's too many tags for all these different, you know, in the old days it was rock, hard rock, and heavy metal, and new wave, and punk.
Sure.
And now there's so many different genres, it's ridiculous to keep up. It's like pot. There's so many different names. How do you keep up with all of them? You know, it's either it's good or it's bad. That's what I say. There's great hip hop and there's great R&B and there's wonderful rock and roll and there's good metal and there's great death metal stuff. It's all, you know, there's just too much stuff out there. I think it's, if you can take the categories and try to separate them without having so many of them, it would be much better for the music industry as opposed to having 30 different things of different kinds of music when they're all super close.
Yeah, about a year ago, I was sitting down talking to Mark Slaughter, and we were talking about sort of this, the emergence of what I guess people look back on now as 90s alternative. And he sort of had an outlook like, look, these were great bands that were coming out. Like that Nirvana album's great, you know. It's just the problem really was that the record companies were like, well, now we need to have 5 Nirvanas, 3 Alice in Chains, maybe a couple of Soundgardens and a Pearl Jam. But I think that if it hadn't been the record companies looking that way, and it's obviously easy for me to say not being a part of it, I just thought like, oh, you know, that sure, Nevermind, Nirvana's Nevermind was a great album. Kiss had a great album called Revenge that came out during this, you know, the year after that. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite albums doesn't fit into any of these molds, Soul Asylum's Grave Dancers Union, but your album Strength, the band's second album Strength, is also a great album, but it was just, I guess what, the record companies just weren't as focused on maybe a band like yours. Was that the problem, or...?
I can't pinpoint what the problem is. There's a lot of different stuff going on in the music business back then, and you know, I don't really have a rear view mirror to go back there. But if I had to guesstimate, you know, first of all, there's only one Nirvana and there's only one Alice in Chains for sure. Okay, there's not 5 of them. Maybe they tried to find 5 of those, but they never did because there's not 5 out there.
Right, and that's the problem.
Those are great bands, and you know, for the bands that took an ass whooping back then, maybe it was time for them. Maybe they had their day in the sun. It was time to move on. It wasn't for Enough's Enough. We had a lot of songs, and we tons of critical acclaim, and we didn't give it enough time. So we stuck out there and broke our asses to get a chance to crack through and be considered a band that was established and that had something to say. So for those bands, that whole change of the guard back then, I see a lot of bands. That was Mudhoney. They didn't really make it, and they were in that whole little thing, you know. But Soundgarden did. And those other Pearl Jam did obviously very well, and they stuck it out there. And they were having – there was a problem with them in the early days too because bands were fighting. There was a lot of infighting with all those bands as well. But when I look back, I got to say that the bands that stuck it out there, we all were taking an ass whooping for a while because it was a change in the industry.
Yeah.
Really, it was a change of the guard. I think that we were all smart enough to know that just be careful, you know, and – realize that this business is predicated on friendships and relationships. Don't cause any trouble. Don't fight with anybody. It's terrible press. Just wait your turn. You're going to get back in there again and get a chance.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you hear about a lot of these bands who were dropped from their record label, and obviously that happened to Enough's Enough, but what I didn't realize is that you actually filed for bankruptcy, then you go on another record label, and there's a series of record labels.
Yep.
A lot of these stories that you hear stop with the, well, we lost our record deal.
Yeah.
And talk about how that wasn't, you know, that wasn't going to be the end for you in particular, but
no,
for your band
we finished that second record, which all our rock star buddies from Cheap Trick to Kiss all call it a classic. That Strength record, we recorded 30 songs for that record. Record company never came down. One time we were here in Los Angeles. We did we were at One-on-One for a little while recording, and then we got bumped out of there, and we went over to Music Grinder and did the rest of the record because Alice in Chains was doing their record at One-on-One. And we recorded 30 songs in the record company. Derek Shulman came by. Derek Shulman, the old lead singer of Gentle Giant, came by the studio and says, guys, we have a good problem here. And we said, well, what's that? He says, too many good songs. Let's cut it down. Let's make the record, 14, 15 song record. And we said, yeah, we can do that. And this is right during that whole change of the guard with the Seattle scene that was happening. So when we made that record, the first thing we did was we got in a tour bus and went out and started touring around the country. We were out with Dee Snider for a while. He was doing his solo stuff. And it was really going well for us. We thought, well, you know, we have a chance here. There's some gas in this tank. But then we found ourselves behind the eight ball every time. It was 10 steps forward, 30 steps back. We had a lot of trouble with our behavior and our intake. And I'll be the first to say that. The inmates were in the asylum.
Yeah.
And we found ourselves behind the eight ball quite a few times. No pun intended. But we've turned it around, and we kept making records, and we knew we had good songs.
Yeah.
And all our contemporaries and our colleagues all said, you guys got a great band, you know, don't stop. And we didn't. And I think a lot of those bands out there, they were disillusioned by what happened in the business. And they said, maybe it's just time to move on. Maybe this isn't the business for me. Maybe I should just go get a job and work as a lawyer, or attorney, or a cook, or whatever it may be, or a fireman. Those are all good gigs, too. We need all of the guys. They're very important. But for us, it was like, this is really all we know how to do. Let's start songs and go out there and play, because we're comfortable in that skin.
I referred to Howard Stern earlier, and I know somebody else who was a big fan of the band was David Letterman. Yeah. Like, he had you on both of his shows, his NBC show and his CBS show. Yeah. And I mean, and this is, you know, obviously now there's 1,000 channels, and there were only like 200 back then. So it's, you know, talk about sort of what the difference that makes. Sure, getting played on MTV is great, but then when you're on, and I know it was the old show was at 12:30, but. Yeah. Being on a network TV show, I mean, that had to be, especially maybe the first time you're on, there had to be some kind of bump from that, or is that more just perceived by people watching in the audience?
I think the first big show was obviously MTV and Beavis and Butthead. That was good.
Right. Did that help you? Because I've heard Kip Winger talk about how it definitely didn't help his band, because they just sort of looked at him as like, hey, this sucks, you know? And then I think that sort of led, maybe didn't lead a sea change, but it was sort of like, it was a nagging thing in a lot of people's, the back of their mind was, hey, I don't think I like this band. You're right, Beavis and Butthead. Or do you feel like it actually helped?
Well, Winger was almost like a secondary character in there, because the guy wore the Winger shirt. And he was a little derogatory.
A little guy named Stewart, yeah.
Kip forgets that he made by the way, I love Kip Winger, okay? He's a friend of mine. He's a wonderful singer, great writer, and I have nothing but love. If he knocked on my door and said, I got nowhere to live, I'd take him in right now, because I mean, he's a great, great guy. But I think Kip, it's called selective memory. He forgets that every time he was on MTV, he sold 5,000-6,000 records a week.
That's a great point.
You know, he was selling 20,000, 30,000 units a month when he was on MTV, because it was putting his name in everybody's in their ears. So in some ways, it was great. I know Sebastian Bach, who's a superstar rock singer from Skid Row, he was pissed and wanted to fight the program director down at MTV because he felt that they were being disrespectful to his legacy. But he obviously didn't go to the bank right away and check his money, because he was getting paid. Beavis and Butthead was really helping a lot of those bands that weren't getting tons of airplay at the time. So I think it was good for us. But getting to your question about David Letterman, it helped elevate our perception beyond belief. And if it wasn't for us doing Howard Stern show, we would never got Letterman, because Howard took us in. He was a proponent in the early days. He welcomed us with open arms. He would talk about all the different experiences that we had. He loved all that bad stuff that was about Enough's Enough.
Sure.
He focused on that, and he swam in it and loved it. So when he talked about us on the air and pushed the band, it got back to Letterman's people. When they booked the band, that week was a wonderful week. We did Baby Loves You the first time. Record sales went up exponentially. Got a better tour. We were playing arenas and sheds with Nelson opening, following around Guns N' Roses and Skid Row. It was a wonderful opportunity for us. So sometimes you look at those little things. It's not bad to show your warts and scars and tattoos, and that's what we were doing at that time. And it was really good for us. And because that show was so successful, we were able to go back on there again and play. And we developed a friendship and a relationship. I remember sneaking in the back of Letterman's show and during the show and smoking pot back there in the boiler room. Morty was the producer, says, you're not supposed to smoke in a building, but if you guys are going to smoke, go in the back there. There's a little boiler room, and we went back there and we were smoking pot. And it was a lot of fun, and we shared a cigar with Letterman, actually, back there.
Oh, nice.
But he was a big proponent, and I think anytime you can get in any network shows, it's going to be good for you. You got to look at it the positive, okay, because you don't get a second chance on a first impression. So you get those moments, you go up there, you play, you do a great job, and people remember that, and it goes a long way. And there's stories I could tell you about that are unprintable, okay?
Right.
Really great moments that happen with that, because when you're around different people, more opportunities happen, and that was really good for the band.
Well, talking about being around people, I'm not as interested in the fact that, you know, you were with Madonna, obviously, but sort of what is that? You know, that's a different orbit than pretty much anybody. What does that do for sort of you're talking about your ego, sort of like if you're with someone of that stature versus, you know, other bands who are successful but not that level, what does that do for you just as a person and you know, the way that you look at your career?
You just move on with it. You're just grateful for the little stages and that, you know, places that you can jump onto and talk about, and they're part of your footnote in life.
Yeah.
That's it. And that's a, you don't want to do anything. You want to be disrespectful. You don't want to say anything bad about anybody.
Oh, yeah. And just, that's not what I mean at all. I just mean in the moment, what does that do? Like, you know, are you, you is your life that much different or is it really?
Nah, you don't know. You really don't know about that.
Right.
You know, if you just, well, things happen in life, people talk about them. And sometimes it's better to just let the legacy stay where it's at and leave that alone. And I want to be remembered for great songs that I've written with my band and the wonderful shows that we played. And hey, movies and soundtracks are fun, too. Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer or
yeah.
Mad Dog and Glory. Any of the big TV shows that we've done. I like focusing on that good musical stuff because that's for everybody. The extracurricular activities and the substance abuse stories and stuff and hanging out with the big rock stars all night, drinking and smoking, doing blow. That's for us to keep for ourselves.
Right, exactly.
I think.
You know, it's funny. We've got about 10 minutes left, and we sort of basically blew through all the time we had. I put on my first page that I wanted to talk about the new album first, and then we just got all caught up, and
well,
it was
nice
a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
But I do want to talk about the new album.
Yes.
I read a recent interview. You characterized just the band in general. I love this, so I wrote it out word for word. A potpourri of pop, rock, alternative, and heavy metal. And I think that those different sounds, that sort of hodgepodge is really on display on the new album, Diamond Boy. And I think that there's this really cohesive sound to the album, which, again, new albums aren't that common anymore. But when they do come out, it's usually just like, here's a bunch of songs that we hope we sell for, you know, what, $1.39 each on iTunes. But this really felt like an album from beginning to end. How much of a focus was it to sort of not even have a singular sound? It's, you know, it's not like this is a concept album or anything, but having it be a collection of songs that, that really feels like they should be grouped together.
Well, it's one continuous thought, this record, all the way through. It's about what's happening in our, through our eyes in today's day and age, okay? And I'm picking off the bones of my favorite bands. That's all I'm doing. And you show me a band without influences, I'll show you a band who hasn't written one damn note, okay? And I've been writing songs for years and years, and sometimes they come up and they're really good, and you commend yourself, and other times you go, I've fallen a little bit short here. But I think this record's a really solid rock record that and people ask me and everybody talks about, oh, we're not listening to this kind of music. And we listen, when I'm off tour, I listen to Beethoven and Bach and Mozart and listen, this record, this new Enough Snuff album here, it's if you took David Bowie and the Beatles, picture them guys fist fighting in an alley and Cheap Trick comes in and breaks it up, that's the new Enough Snuff album. Okay, that's simple. At least I'm being honest.
I would love to hear that.
And you can hear the record for yourself. And if you get a chance, you know, listen to a song or two and see what if it trips your trigger. But I know at the end of the day, I'm really proud of what we've come up with as a band. And obviously, I've been charted in 157 on the Billboard charts. I haven't charted in 25 years, 16 in the UK, 34 independent charts in the United States. I know these numbers. I would never remember this stuff, but I know them because my record company, Frontiers, they tell me all the time, they commend me and pat me on the back going, you made a great record here. Keep it up, bro. Keep working really hard. And the first single has done very well for us, and I'm just going to go out there and play these songs. And I know there's a ton of fans out there that want to hear rock and roll, and it's still alive, folks. There's the biggest bands in the world are the rock bands out there. They're playing stadiums and huge arenas and stuff, and that's what I'm working my way toward. Right now, we're doing House of Blueses and Wiltern Theaters and Paramount Theaters, playing nice, respectful 1,500-seat, 2,000-seat venues. And a couple of years ago, I was playing clubs for 150 people, 200 people, honest to God. It's a tough business, and if you can teeter-totter, it's about peaks and valleys. And for the haters out there, sorry, guys, I'm not going away. Band is around, and we're going to be kicking ass for, I think, for quite a while, so... for the fans that have been supporting us all these years and stuff, I want to say I hope you all live to be 100 years old. It's a great record here, and I'm real proud of it, and I hope to see you on this Live Nation tour. We'll be out until November. Bring your peace signs and paisleys.
In our final couple minutes, talking about the recording of the album, I think I read this, that the band basically played live in studio, which I think really helps sort of give it a sound, you know, instead of doing all the tracks individually, which I think that, you know, the idea was that the technology kept getting better and better and better, and you could have more and more tracks, but then the music started to sound a little bit more disjointed. So talk about the decision, one, to just actually play live in the studio, and then just for somebody who's more of a music nerd and has never really been around a recording studio, what is the benefit of recording on analog tape?
Oh, I think it's like listening to old records from the 70s and 80s. They sound great. the quality. It's warm. It's punchy. It's powerful. You get every little nuance, all the little nooks and crannies, the little bells and whistles that you wouldn't normally get. We can go in a studio and make I can make 30 records in a year if been just Pro Tool the whole thing together and just get on a computer and just play a couple little parts and fix it up and have the guy that's in there with me tweaking it all up and cutting stems together like a lot of the hip hop bands do.
Sure.
By the way, when we were making this record, it was Kanye West and Chance the Rapper in the other room recording.
Oh, wow.
And those guys are just doing, they got 10 guys in there with computers putting together parts. I've watched them and I go, they're geniuses for what they could do, but it's 10 young guys in there and they're syncing their machines together trying to find, you know, a keyboard part here and a little hook here and a vocal line here. And it's an art to do that. Don't get me wrong. And Chance is very talented as well, just like Kanye. But it's a whole different game. We get in there, we play, and it's like, here's a song, guys. You show them on acoustic guitar or on a piano, and then the band learns it, and we play it. And that difference is you're in there, and any little mistakes, any warts or scars that you're going to have in the music on 2-inch tape, it's going to show. And I thought that was the beauty of this record. It's not a perfect record whatsoever, but what is perfect about it is it's real. And that's what's exciting about that. And we went in Pro Tools at the end of the record. After we recorded drums and bass guitars and stuff, we obviously went to the Pro Tools. You got to go to Digital Domain because you're going to sing on the songs and there's vocal parts you're going to do. But for the most part, it's a real live, old-fashioned rock and roll record. It's real 1970s where lo-fi and hi-fi mix together. And I think it's a great balance.
Yeah, and just sort of a stray thought as you're talking about albums from the 70s. You know, I saw Ace Frehley open for Alice Cooper last month at the Greek Theater.
Right.
And, you know, Ace is the first performer. And his warm-up, basically they play the Aerosmith Rocks album from beginning to end.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't, you know, there's just, like, what else do you need?
Yeah.
So if you can get something that feels like one of those albums from the 70s, which I think that it's a great point because this is very reminiscent of that.
Yeah.
And the album we're talking about is Diamond Boy. I know that you know, it's very small on the camera here for those see it, but you can get on CD. And I was talking to Chip beforehand how excited I was that there's actually liner notes and there's lyrics and all the things that you used to get because, you know, look, I'm 42, so I still want all this, but you can always get it digitally. And for people who just want to check it out, you can go, I don't know if it's your band has a YouTube channel or Frontiers has a YouTube channel, but you can hear some of the songs there too if you just want to check it out. But what they should really do is go check out Enough's Enough, Bullet Boys, and Jack Russell's Great White on the SiriusXM Hair Nation tour and buy the CDs directly from you there at the show. Tickets information on the tour and the album, enoughsenough.com. Chip, I really appreciate you spending so much time just chatting with me. It was a ton of fun. Great to get to meet you and just to get to talk to you.
Chris and I, we could sit and talk for hours, you and I, because we're both music fans before anything else, okay? And on behalf of your AfterBuzz TV and the people over at Live Nation, I thank you so much for having me on here. And all the fans, without you guys, we wouldn't be here. Hope to see you at the shows. And I will see you in your hometown with bells and whistles.
Thanks so much, Chip. Thanks so much, everybody. I'm Christian Blatt. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ChristianDMZ. Thanks again, and we'll see you soon.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.